On a Jobs Day Friday, these three things are true. Number one, the economy is growing. Number two, we're basically at full employment. And number three, there is going to be a big tax cut. Number four, I guess, then becomes, then what happens? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday. This one is the 8th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We got jobs. We got a short-term government funding fix. We got a tax bill all but done, maybe. We also got Sheila Kolhatkar. She writes for The New Yorker magazine. And Kate Davidson, she is at The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Sheila, let me give you a first crack at the jobs report. 228,000 new jobs. Unemployment stays at 4.1%. Wages up a touch. All in all, steady as she goes. Stay the course. Pretty good, right?
Well, the U.S. has been adding jobs now for 86 months in a row, which is remarkable. So President Trump is trying to take credit for this. But of course, this is a continuation of a trend that's been going on for quite a while. There was some encouraging signs around wage growth, but I think it's fair to say that a lot of economists remain a bit frustrated as to why wages are not going up more in light of how low unemployment is.
Right. And it's not just, regular economists. I mean, Janet Yellen at the Fed, Kate, says the same thing. We just don't get it on wages and the related problem of inflation being basically flat in this country.
Right. Janet Yellen was up on the Hill a couple weeks ago testifying and continues to say this is one of the biggest mysteries that policymakers are encountering is, right, what is going on with wages and inflation? And the relationship that used to be there doesn't seem to be working the way it should. Mm-hmm. That is, right, as the labor market tightens, the jobless rate goes down, we start to see wages go up. And, yeah, they're going up, but not as much as we typically would see.
Right. OK, so, Sheila, let me turn toward the tax bill and sort of the macro implications. The House and Senate are going to go to conference. We have, as I said in the open, an economy basically at full employment. We have an economy that is growing. And now we are going to stimulate it, the Republicans say, with big corporate tax cuts. What is
well,
the
so
future
American-
going to bring? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, American companies are actually doing really well overall. And the companies in the S&P 500 have been showing higher profits all year, higher than they've been in 6 years. So a lot of people believe that they don't actually need such a large corporate tax cut. And, a lot of analysts looking at the tax proposals are predicting that ultimately what could end up happening is those companies are going to end up passing along a lot of those savings to shareholders through the form of dividends. And then, of course, the stock prices of those companies are likely to rise.
Right.
So you're going to see a lot of shareholders, corporate executives who own stock in those companies reaping a lot of the benefits of the tax cut. And the middle class taxpayers who are supposedly going to be helped by this will not be seeing the majority of the benefits.
Right. Kate, let me ask you this question since you're in Washington. Is it your sense that the House is going to move toward the Senate as they try to reconcile these two bills, or is the Senate going to go toward the House?
I think it's still a little bit up in the air. I think, yes, generally, it's probably the House is going to move toward the Senate. Senate votes, both chambers will have to vote on
right.
whatever final bill comes out of this committee. And we know that the Senate tends to be trickier to get those votes secured. So that's our sense. But there are definitely things that I think the Senate will have to compromise with the House on. So it just remains to be seen. And I think it's important to remember, while we may see some of this happening in public, a lot of these conversations and these deals are going to be worked out behind the scenes.
Right. Sheila, here's a little bit marketplace behind the scenes. I've been saying around the office today, I'm reasonably sure that this tax bill is going to pass and it's going to become a done deal. I'd like to get from the two of you a sense of how you see this playing out. Sheila, you get to go first.
Well, the way that they're doing this is obviously a little bit alarming and it's somewhat unprecedented. You know, when President Reagan passed a major tax cut in 1986, there were dozens of hearings. And it was a much more carefully thought through process. And here we see these bills being rushed through to the point where the members who are voting on them don't even always know what's in them. And there are likely to be unintended consequences and even in some cases outright errors. And that's already happened. And that's part of the reason they're now having to go and reconcile the bills rather than having the House just vote on the version the Senate approved.
So you don't want to take a stand. Is that what I hear you saying? You're going to punt on that one?
I'm a little troubled by the way this is happening, the lack of transparency.
Yeah, Kate, what do you think? What's going to happen?
Well, I think, and I will have to credit my colleagues who cover tax policy with talking about this, you know, over the course of the year when we saw what happened with Obamacare and how spectacularly that stumbled over and over again, we were all a little bit skeptical. Can they really get this done on taxes? But I think as the year has gone on and they're now facing down, a primary election season next year, the imperative to show, hey, voters who elected us, we can get things done is just so important to the party right now. I think that they're just willing to come together, I hate to say kind of on anything, but it seems like there's a strong motivation to get something done.
Kate Davidson of the Wall Street Journal and Sheila Kolhatkar from the New Yorker magazine. Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, what? Me worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is, we are told, a breakthrough deal between the Brits and their European Union soon-to-be former partners over Brexit. A couple of key items got hashed out last night in negotiations, including that Irish border thing we told you about a couple of days ago. So cutting to the chase here, attention is now going to turn to talking about a future trade relationship between the Brits and Brussels. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk in London, American companies do have quite a bit of skin in this game.
More than 7,500 US companies have set up operations in the UK and invested more than $500 billion here. Not because they like the weather. They've been using the UK as a springboard, says Emmanuel Adam. He's with British American Business, an organisation representing 220 companies, everything from small firms to multinationals.
For many, many years, American companies have used the UK as a bridge into a much larger market, which is the European single market.
He says that American companies based here were overwhelmingly in favour of the UK staying in the EU. Now many are rooting for the UK at least to keep the closest possible ties with the bloc after Brexit. Today's breakthrough, Adam says, is a relief.
That announcement provides us with some hope that talks are now moving ahead into the next phase.
American farmers may not be quite so happy about today's breakthrough, especially if they'd been hoping for a free trade deal with Britain after Brexit. Selling their genetically modified crops, hormone-treated beef and chlorine-washed chicken to the UK. All this American produce is banned by the EU, and the Brits have in effect pledged to abide by EU farm regulations under today's deal. George Parker of the Financial Times.
It does limit Britain's room for manoeuvre, I think, in terms of future trade deals and also the kind of regulation that the British Parliament passes in future.
Next week, European leaders will decide whether Britain can proceed to the next phase of Brexit talks, which are likely to be every bit as turbulent as the first phase. Thousands of American exporters will be watching keenly. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As Sheila and Kate and I were talking about, the tax bill could soon be in the rearview mirror, which means the White House is going to be looking for something to do come New Year. There have been reports the past couple of days that something could be the long-awaited infrastructure plan. The White House, in theory, riding high after getting the tax bill done. But it turns out the tax bill itself has some infrastructure experts a bit concerned, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Lots of people who closely follow infrastructure issues have lots of problems with this tax plan. Casey Dinges is with the American Society of Civil Engineers.
First of all, the Highway Trust Fund is not being dealt with, and it's a missed opportunity to not fix the Highway Trust Fund with this tax bill.
That's the chronically underfunded program that pays to build and fix highways. It couldn't be included under rules that allowed the tax plan to pass on a party line vote. On top of what isn't in the bill, there's what is. Elizabeth Keller is with the International City County Management Association.
We're concerned about the private activity bonds,
otherwise known as PABs. They let private companies get a tax break for investing in public works. Keller's group is one of many calling for the House to keep the tax-exempt status of those bonds.
That has been a helpful tool to spur infrastructure investment, and that has been eliminated on one side of the chamber. So it's up for debate in the conference committee.
And then there's the money problem, says Jeff Davis of the Eno Center for Transportation.
Coming on the heels of a $1.5 trillion deficit finance tax bill and several hundred billion dollars of appropriation spending increases, plus the disaster aid for hurricanes that are all going to go through in the next 2 weeks.
He says people may be a little hesitant to spend another $200 billion on infrastructure next month. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There is a group of consumers in this economy, a demographic group to be a bit more specific, that is of special value to marketers. It's the biggest group. They overtook baby boomers a couple of years ago, and they have money to spare for toys and clothes and electronics and whatnot. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath aged out of that group this week, but he is not going without a fight.
Yeah, I turned 35 on Monday, but I'm not that sad about my hair thinning or that thing with my knee. What really gets me is that I'm no longer in the coveted 18 to 34 demographic.
I feel your pain. When I turned 35 last year, I experienced the same anxiety.
That's ad man Michael Miraflor.
SVP, Global Head of Futures and Innovation.
At the agency Blue 449.
You know, 18 to 34 has been regarded for so long as the young demographic. So when you age out of that, you're like, okay, now what am I considered?
Old, Michael, and irrelevant. That's the sad part. See, literally my entire adult life, from the minute I turned 18 until this week, my opinions have moved markets. For advertisers,
it's about the opportunity to kind of convert those 18 to 34-year-olds into brands and products and services that they'll use for the rest of their lives.
Miraflor explains these demos were created back in the Mad Men days, when age was a proxy for interests. Young people like fizzy soda and fast cars. Old people like iced tea and slow cars. Sell them stuff accordingly. And if you want to help an old person feel young, sell them a sports car, of course. This gave me an idea. What if I could use my final days of relevance to sort of pull the culture towards me? Living it up, consuming all the stuff I love, I could signal to advertisers that this stuff is cool. So that's what I did. For example, I love ambient music, new agey drones and tones type stuff. Last week, I went to see Laurel Halo, who you're hearing right now. I bought the ticket with my credit card. That's a data point Capital One will sell to advertisers. I also posted all over social media, dozens of tweets and likes and snaps. Together, all those data points make a little data constellation that, if it's bright enough, tells advertisers, hey, look over here. This stuff must be cool because look at who's consuming it. End result?
You might start to see some of that music in some of the advertising that you're being targeted with.
Lee Macon is chief strategy officer at ad agency 360i. And
my birthday is Monday, December 4th as well.
You, me, and Jay-Z.
Yes, the three of us.
Macon also entered a new demographic today, 45 plus.
I am. I'm admitting that on air, yeah.
And he's brought me the greatest gift I could ask for.
Age is still valuable. It's not the whole story.
In the era of big data, Macon says, age is just one data point. Now, he says, it almost works the opposite of the Mad Men days. If young people get into iced tea and slow cars, or, you know, seltzer, vinyl records, mom jeans, advertisers learn that from the data and adjust the demographics. Also,
rather than see things by demographic, we're able to see adjacent passions.
If I really wanted to boost the signal on my music taste, Macon says, I should have spent the last week consuming fashion and gadgets and fine dining, too. Then the data would correlate my taste in music with all that other coveted consumption.
So is it fair to say that this little culture hacking experiment I've been doing, I could do that all this year while I'm 35, and it will matter just as much as doing it last year when I was 34?
It'll matter just as much.
So I'm still relevant?
Yes.
Still got it. I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
What was great was that little pause before the guy said, yes, Ryan, you're still relevant. Anyway, coming up,
We tend to believe that Christmas today is a horrible, terrible commercial corruption.
Wait, it's not? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 117 points this Friday, almost a half percent, finished at 24,329. The NASDAQ up 27 points, about 0.4%, 6840. The S&P 500 rose 14 points, a half percent there, 26.51. For the week, the Dow up 0.4%, NASDAQ down about 0.1%, S&P 500 down 0.3%. Hanukkah begins on Tuesday, and Christmas is just three shopping weekends away. Toymaker Hasbro ended flat today. Mattel off 0.2%. Macy's gained about 2%. Stock prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. So please don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Scott Tong, now on our sustainability desk. A number of years ago, though, our Shanghai correspondent did a fellowship a couple of years back. He spent it, I guess, doing what fellows do, taking some classes, hanging around. Also, though, writing a book about his family's story in China and about them getting out of China. It's called A Village With My Name. Scott, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, Kai. Thanks.
I thought for a while about where to start with this book because there's a whole lot in it. I want you to start with your dad. Tell me about your dad.
Sure. My dad is the great globalization American story. So my dad was 10 years old when he fled out of China with his father in 1949. So the communists came and he gets out on there were two boats that were taking refugees from China over to Taiwan.
Yeah.
And he gets on the boat that didn't sink. The one that did had casualties on the order of the Titanic, you know, more than 1,000 people. So every family has one of these miracle stories, right, once you start looking into it, and that's part of it. So he goes to Taiwan. It's part of this, you know, American umbrella, and basically takes the ladder, takes the escalator of globalization, comes to the United States. He's an engineer, goes to graduate school in Minnesota, works for IBM, the only company he ever wanted to work for.
Wow.
We all have heard a lot of those stories, and that's the story that I grew up with, the narrative and the framing. I just didn't have the story of those who didn't make it out.
Which is the next question, because your dad has a brother.
Yeah.
And he is the guy who was left behind.
That's right.
And it's a long, convoluted family story. I'm going to ask you to compress it for radio's sake.
Absolutely. My father was the fortunate one to get out.
Right.
And my uncle was the one left behind. And until I went to China in 2006 for Marketplace and got to know this uncle, I didn't know his story. And it is this great, for Americans far away, this great undertold story of what happened behind the curtain of China under Mao. His story is one of great suffering, being punished during the Cultural Revolution. And the reason he was punished was because he had overseas relations, right? Mm-hmm. This is when it was not okay to be connected to the outside world.
And to be clear, the overseas relations, that's your dad and your grandfather, the ones who left.
That's right. Having relatives overseas in Taiwan, and it was his father who was connected to the previous regime that lost the war.
One of the things you and I have talked about, both when you were in China and since you've come back, and when I was over there with you and we were doing our reports from over there, is how intertwined our economic fortunes are, our two countries. It seems in this current moment that there is a will on the part of the leadership of the United States to try to disentangle those futures. Do you think that's possible?
I think it's pretty hard. I think the well-being of people in China is very connected to the United States. When China opened up, a lot of the capital that flowed in was American. The markets that China sold their goods to, a lot of them came to the United States. A lot of the students came here. I mean, the you can draw all of these dotted and straight lines, I think, between China and the United States for the China side of the story and the U.S. side of the story. Free trade has brought by one measure, a measure of a basket of clothing. The price hasn't gone up since 1986. Yeah. I mean, we don't really think about how prices have kind of stayed low for a lot of basic kind of commodity things. And part of that is globalization. Part of that is the most efficient countries, you know, produce what the world uses. So the story up to now is a pretty interconnected story. It would be hard to disentangle it, although, you know, the United States, the administration is kind of doing what it can to try to do that, kind of pulling back from these trade deals. If you pull back, you're losing customers, right? You're raising your drawbridge a little bit from the world.
I want to get back to your dad
yeah.
on the way out here and the book, A Village with My Name. You found the village. You found your family's village.
We didn't think it existed.
Yes.
We had old bad information about whether it still existed along the Grand Canal in eastern China in the middle of nowhere, kind of Jiangsu province. In the end, it took a full day, almost gave up, and we did find it. Everybody there has the same last name. Very surprising, and we got a we kind of got the story of my great grandfather, who was the first out of the village, kind of the first mover in our family. It was a great story, except it was incomplete, and parts of it were wrong. And which means you always have to go somewhere twice to get the real story.
Scott Tong, it's called A Village with My Name: A Family History of China's Opening to the World. It's quite a read, actually. Scott, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've heard the complaints, right? Perhaps made some yourself, that the holiday season, the Christmas season specifically, has changed. How it used to be all about family and the spirit of the moment, and now it's just capitalism run rampant. Judith Flanders, in her new book, Christmas, A Biography, says we've got it a little bit wrong. It's the latest installment of our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
We tend to believe that Christmas today is a horrible, terrible commercial corruption of what was a warm, loving family holiday that before that was a purely religious day. In actual fact, Christmas has always been about consumption. For most of Christmas's history, it was about food and drink. Then what happened was in the 19th century, with the growth of the middle classes, with lower prices for consumer objects, we began to see the shift into it being a time when people gave children presents, you began to buy things for Christmas, and it changed to a different kind of consumption. I think the core of Christmas is the idea that something magical happens. And let's face it, most of life isn't magic. So we like to believe that there was a better time, whether it's our own childhoods, when things were simpler. So it's like those Norman Rockwell illustrations of the perfect family dinner on Sunday after church. Most people, including, I'm sure, Norman Rockwell himself, did not have childhoods like that. But the most important thing that we have bought about Christmas is the idea that it was better before. The earliest reference I found was 1616, when the playwright Ben Jonson wrote in one of his plays, he has one of the characters saying, "Oh, Christmas today is an awful, horrible thing. It used to be so much better." We have been saying this for half a millennium.
Judith Flanders there. Her book is called Christmas, A Biography. This final note on the way out today, as Bitcoin sits at somewhere between $15,000 and $16,000 a piece, depending on which trading platform you check, which is, frankly, part of the problem. Anyway, the CEO of Coinbase, the biggest cryptocurrency exchange in this country, posted a letter on Medium today. The headline says it all: "Please invest responsibly. Digital currencies are volatile," he writes, "and the prices can go up." and down. That last bit will become important once you hear this. The first Bitcoin futures market starts trading Sunday afternoon on the Chicago Board Options Exchange, so one could, should one so desire, short Bitcoin. That is, bet it will go down. Standard disclaimer applies here, y'all. Consult your own financial advisor, please. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 117 today, almost a half percent. The NASDAQ up 27, 0.4%. S&P 500 up 14, a half percent there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.